Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seat. We do have a quorum present, and the first item of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Botany, would you like to move the minutes, please?
I have read the minutes, and I would like to move them, Chair Fisher.
Representative Botany moves the minutes from March 1st, 2023. Any questions or amendments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, and the minutes from March 1st, 2023 are approved. First item we have today is going to be a bill from on House File 2284. Before I get to that, I do want to mention this is first deadline week, so it will be rather busy. We do have six bills on the agenda today, so we are going to be cruising right along. So to Representative Finke, you have House File 2284. Would you like to move and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I would move that to refer House File 2284 to the General Register.
Representative Finke moves House File 2284 to the General Register. Please go ahead and explain your bill.
This is a simple technical bill that modifies the language around court examiners to make it easier to do border state work. That's it. It's a very simple bill.
Okay, and I understand you also have a testifier. You'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
For the record, my name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment. And this bill is was heard earlier, Chair members, my apologies. This bill was heard earlier in session for an informational hearing. It truly is a technical cleanup bill of the PA APRN bill that passed last year. There was a change in the language that made an advanced practice registered nurse certified in mental health and licensed in a bordering state to act as a court examiner for a Minnesota resident admitted to a facility in the bordering state. This change in language created a conflict with the Civil Commitment Act with the definitions of an examiner and a court examiner in that part of statute, and this is simply cleaning it up. The solution is the change in the language will allow a person to be an examiner or a court examiner if they meet the qualifications under statute.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Well, first of all, is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House File 2284? Hearing none, are there any questions from members or comments? Hearing none, seeing there's no further discussion, Representative Finke, will you offer closing comments and renew your motion?
I renew my motion, and I ask members to support. This is a bill everyone should agree to. I'm hoping it can get on the consent calendar. It should be no problem moving this forward. It's a necessary fix.
Okay, Representative Finke renews her motion that House File 2284 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor of referring House File 2284 to be placed on the General Register signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries, and House File 2284 is approved to go to the General Register. Next item on the agenda today is House File 1627. Oops, sorry. Excuse me. 1771. Because this is a bill by Representative Bierman. If Representative Bierman would like to come down. I am not seeing Rep. Bierman at the moment, so what we would probably do, we'll pause for just a minute here as we figure this out. Okay, we will go to Rep. Klowski then. They are here. If you'd like to come down, and I've got to get to that part of my script. Just give me a second here. Okay, so we are going to House File 2008 from Representative Kozlowski. Since Representative Kozlowski is not a member of this committee, I will move to refer House File 2008 to the Children's and Family Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Kozlowski, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an A1 author's amendment. Could you please move the, I will move the author's A1 amendment. Could you please explain it to us, please?
Yes, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here for House File 2008. And yes, this is a technical amendment. We would just like it to be considered in order to better clarify eligibility and the types of services that will be offered.
Okay, members, any questions on the A1 offers amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 offers amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We'll go back to the bill. Representative Kozlowski, please explain your bill as amended.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you for the opportunity for hearing this bill today. I'm proud to be here with a number of folks from my district, from a number of folks who have been working in collaboration on this homeless youth direct cash transfer pilot bill. This is brought forth in partnership with the Opportunity Youth Network and many others, and has been a proposal in partnership between St. Louis County, Hennepin County, homeless youth service providers, community-based organizations, research institution, but most importantly, our youth have been driving and will be in the driver's seat as this is implemented. With evidence-based practices in mind, House File 2008 is really an effort to intentionally focus on specific homeless youth and also give them the hand up needed to create stable, successful lives. I also want to just call attention that there's a handout which has been provided with much more detail about the needs and the mechanics of our proposal. But basically, this bill is to create a four-year pilot in which this coalition works with an intermediary organization to allocate a monthly stipend to eligible homeless youth ages 18 to 24. And in order for this pilot program to be most effective, House File 2008 waives the stipend from counting as an income. This really enables individuals to maintain their eligibility and to receive other services that are necessary, as we know, to stabilize and secure their lives. So, Chair, I would ask to give you a face and a voice to the challenges that many of our homeless youth experience and how this pilot can address the situation. I have a handful of testifiers here to offer some brief remarks, and I will turn it now over to my first testifier.
Very good. Thank you for the presentation. If you'd like to go ahead, introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jordan Unison Chisty. I'm the executive director of Lifehouse, which is located in Duluth. We serve homeless and streetwise young people ages 14 to 24 throughout the Northeast region and beyond. Lifehouse serves about 900 young people on an annual basis, with 60% of them being indigenous, black, or youth of color. 42% are young parents. Lifehouse provides vital wraparound supportive services for our youth and young families. We have a drop-in center to access basic needs. We are the access point for young people who needing assistance with housing. We have two residential sites which are licensed. We have a mental health and wellness team for no cost and no insurance, and that ranges from licensed clinical social workers to peer recovery specialists. And we also support youth with their education with a licensed teacher and employment opportunities. My staff of over 40 people know how to handle and navigate youth walking through our doors given their crisis and traumatic situations. We receive funding from the Pathways Home Act to support these vital life-saving services. And this bill, this particular bill, is an opportunity to stabilize and bolster our support for our underserved young community members, who are our future leaders. Imagine having the opportunity to be part of changing history for generations to come. Imagine if you were 19, unstably housed and struggling to survive. If you had cash for housing needs, along with all our wraparound supportive services mentioned above at no cost, to feel fully supported in your life. This bill provides us a way to see what impact we can make in our young people's lives, and who will feel we will trust them and fully support them in their process. This bill allows us to deepen our work beyond crisis intervention. It allows us to engage youth in an opportunity to make a difference for their children and generations to come. So please support House File 2008 and invest in our future generations. And I thank you for your time and commitment in supporting our young people in our communities.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next I have would be Janae Peterson. Hi, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. And I am not Janae. I am Laura Birnbaum, but Janae will follow shortly.
Right.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Laura Birnbaum, and I work for St. Louis County Public Health and Human Services. I supervise our housing and homelessness programs team. I am excited, hopeful, and grateful to be here today to express my support for House File 2008 and encourage yours. We know that young adults ages 18 to 24 are overrepresented when it comes to facing homelessness. This is not only true in metro areas, but also in greater Minnesota rural communities, like those found in St. Louis County. At the end of last week, 173 people ages 18 to 24 were unhoused in St. Louis County. This includes 136 single people, of which 9 are pregnant, and 37 families. The number of young people in our coordinated entry system is not decreasing, despite active efforts to expand permanent supportive housing and related programming. In St. Louis County, we see young people leaving unsafe situations, doing their best, and due to not feeling safe in traditional shelter spaces, will often stay with friends, couch hop, or find shelter in places not meant for human habitation. We also see young people return to homelessness due to financial struggles that are no fault of their own. Young people are connected to benefits that provide a basic level of support, such as food support or SNAP, health insurance like MA. However, this doesn't get anywhere near the need for young people to access housing. Herein lies the gap that direct cash transfers could empower young adults to address. Young people need more tools where they can have ownership, more choices, and flexibility to be able to utilize creativity in determining their own housing solutions, where they can move out of crisis and surviving into thriving, creating the opportunity to break cycles of homelessness and poverty. And we would be able to learn from this work to replicate what works across the state due to the critical research component with Chapin Hall, which you'll hear more about in a little bit. Innovative programming that is responsive to young people's voices and experiences is the solution. They are the experts. Please support House File 2008. This is an amazing opportunity for you and for Minnesota to lead and champion in ending youth homelessness. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you for being here at the committee today. Okay, next, would Janae Peterson be the next person then, or?
Nope. One more minute.
Let's go to Sarah Berger-Gonzalez.
Good afternoon, Chairman Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Berger-Gonzalez, and I'm a senior policy analyst at Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago, an independent nonprofit research and policy center. Chapin Hall's mission is to improve outcomes and well-being for individuals, families, and communities that experience adversity. We collaborate with public agencies, practitioners, community, and fellow knowledge developers to produce rigorous research, build effective services and systems, and accelerate the use in evidence and practice. I have been working in the field of economic supports for well over 15 years, and I am currently part of a team of experts working nationally to reduce the prevalence of youth homelessness along with its human costs. Since 2019, collaborative teams have been working to develop, implement, and study the effectiveness of direct cash transfers with youth-driven supportive services as an intervention to address youth homelessness, bolster racial equity, and enable young people to get on paths to thriving. Here in Minnesota, with initial funding from philanthropy, we have been working with young adults with lived expertise, the provider community, local evaluators, and local government, and implementation partners to adapt the cash transfer model for St. Louis and Hennepin counties. The bill before the committee would make Minnesota the first to take a statewide approach in developing evidence and infrastructure for a scalable policy solution to Minnesota's youth homelessness crisis. I would like to convey three main points concerning the current state of knowledge on supports for young people experiencing homelessness and housing instability. First, current housing solutions for youth and young adults fall short of impact at the population level. Direct cash transfers with supportive services offer a promising solution to addressing youth homelessness in Minnesota. A recent analysis of homelessness systems data across 10 diverse communities found that only one-third of young adults who enter local homelessness systems obtain entry to permanent housing programs, and that those who get housed wait on average 4 to 5 months. Nationally, vouchers are extremely hard to find among young adult-headed households, with less than 3% receiving a voucher. When young people manage to secure housing vouchers, they face insurmountable challenges to deploying them. Other housing programs available to young people are primarily crisis-driven and reactive, and there is little evidence that existing program models help young people achieve and sustain safe and stable housing. During the pandemic, direct cash transfers likely prevented homelessness among millions of American households. We trusted families to deploy funds as they saw fit to positive ends. We can do the same with young people. There is a large international evidence base supporting direct cash transfers as a prompt, safe, and effective way to support individuals experiencing adversity. Direct cash transfers with youth-driven support services, what we call a cash plus model, are a promising solution. HF2008 presents an important opportunity to direct benefits to young people, potentially yielding public cost savings relative to status quo intervention models, expanding promise among young people at a critical time in development, and increasing the likelihood that they will pursue education and occupy their optimal place in the workforce. Second, we need a greater understanding of young people's pathways through homelessness if we wish to inform sustainable systems-level change. Research paints a picture of the risks of homelessness among young people. Although we tend to see homelessness as an individual problem, risk for homelessness is highly unequal among young people, with higher prevalence among American Indian, Alaska Native, Black, multiracial, Hispanic youth, and young adults. Young people identifying as LGBTQI face an increased risk for homelessness, and the intersection of different marginalized identities compounds these inequities. Pregnant and parenting young adults and those who have been involved in public systems like child welfare and juvenile justice also have an increased risk. Even as we have learned much about the drivers of youth homelessness, we lack effective strategies to prevent it, minimize its duration and impact, and avoid reoccurrence. This has enormous human and financial costs. Much of this has to do with the absence of longitudinal data in Minnesota on young people's outcomes and pathways, especially after exiting shelters and other homelessness programs. To this end, this bill will enable critical evidence building. With the right resources, we will learn together whether and how cash and services improve young people's housing situations, enable them to pursue education and vocation, and more. The pilot project here in Minnesota will place Minnesota among a small number of innovators. New York City, San Francisco, California, about a half dozen other jurisdictions are playing cash plus models just like this one. The Chapin Hall team has created a uniform evaluation strategy across sites, enabling us to pool data and understand the differential effects of the program. Minnesota can lead, contribute to, and benefit from this. Finally, an effective Cash Plus program will anticipate, identify, and manage barriers to success so that recipients of cash transfers do not experience this benefit at the expense of other supports, what we commonly know as the benefits cliff. This last November, Chapin Hall published a policy toolkit designed and informed by young people with lived expertise to provide timely analysis and recommendations with respect to designing and implementing DCT programs in ways that minimize risks and maximize benefits. If public assistance benefits or other public resources are withheld or reduced for young people who participate in the Cash Plus intervention, the effective value of the payments will be diminished, possibly producing new adversities and inequalities. As such, the current provisions of HF2008 are quite germane to the success of this program and would enable young adults experiencing homelessness to participate in the pilot without threatening public benefits such as health care, food assistance, and temporary assistance. In closing, passing this legislation places Minnesota among innovators and sets precedent for other states to follow suit, laying the foundation for testing and scaling youth co-design interventions to address homelessness. I wish to express my gratitude on behalf of my colleagues, including Minnesotans with lived expertise. I would be pleased and honored to make myself available to the committee as consideration for HF2008 moves forward. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, and thank you for your testimony. Next, Quincy Powell. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Christy Snyder. I'm clearly not Quincy. He got stuck at the airport, so I'm going to read his testimony. My name is Quincy Poe, and I'm the Opportunity Youth Network co-lead at Youth Prize. Opportunity youth are young people who experience homelessness, have been in the foster care system, young parents, and or youth who are disconnected from educational resources and employment. Youth Prize has been stewarding this work using our connections with young adults and adult partners throughout the state to forward the best policy solutions. Throughout every aspect of doing this work, it has been in partnership with young people that we serve. We conducted adaptation workshops with over 100 young people with lived experience in Hennepin County to learn from them, to understand what they would have wanted to move from surviving to thriving. These would have included housing navigation, mental and chemical health resources, independent living skills, mentorship, financial coaching. As the capacity support at Youth Prize, will do the same adaptation workshops and learn from young people in all parts of St. Louis County to design the same sorts of supportive services that young people may need there. We know that while young people have many things that are similar, the challenges of place can make things radically different. Young people are ready to make big moves for themselves and the community. They just need the right supports to get there. As a former young person who has navigated homelessness in the Twin Cities myself, the impact of what direct cash transfers could have done for me would have been a game changer. Like many of the young people who have partnered with us in this work and focus groups that we have held, when I was homeless and young adult, I often ran into different barriers when trying to get help, barriers that would have me to choose between the help I could get, which would ultimately keep me sustained in my struggle. We have the opportunity to work with young adults in a way where we can be transformative and move the needle forward. An opportunity to say that in Minnesota, we work to look at all of the options on the table that propel the young adults in our communities towards where they can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you so much. Next, I have Miralem St. Clair. Janae's here. Let's take Janae, please. Hi, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and then begin your testimony.
Hello, I'm Janae Peterson. I work for the Hennepin County Youth Advisory Board. I'm very nervous, so.
That's okay. Just take a deep breath.
Sorry. Homeless individuals die at a rate 3 times higher than that of Minnesota's general population. That statistic increases when those who are homeless are under the age of 24. Children at any age can face homelessness. Homelessness and poverty does not discriminate. It does not see a child and think, let me have mercy. I was adopted at 4 from Haiti, and I was left to the system at 11. I was homeless for the first time at age 16. From there, multiple organizations helped me gain stability. From programs that helped me balance school and work, and others that provided financial stability and practical living skills. Many young adults have faced homelessness, like I have. Many did not have the resources I did and died as a result. A program like the direct A program like the direct cash transfer can help add a stable foundation for our community's young adults, so we don't have to pick whether to continue education or starve, so we don't have to worry that we may freeze in a Minnesota winter. The foundation that temporary financial security can provide benefits all. That young adults could be the next neurosurgeon, the next engineer, or the next great author. We are more than what we can see. We are more than what we know. Only the future holds the answers for the questions asked today. Let statistics talk. Let the results move you. It does not hurt to try. But if we do not try at all, we lose irreplaceable lives and potential. Thank you for listening to what the Hennepin Youth Advisory Board has to say today.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to be here, and thank you for your testimony. You did a nice job. Miriam? Okay. Is there Miriam St. Clair? Yep. Come on down. Thank you for being here today. If you'd like to introduce yourself, and then you can begin your testimony, please.
Absolutely. My name is Miriam, and I'm sorry I'm out of breath because I couldn't find parking. I just arrived.
Okay. That's real. Take your time. Take a deep breath.
Thank you so much. This is very important for me, and I hope it's not too much. I hope you do listen to me because I'm an immigrant, and I wondered if I should be here today. But it has been my belief that our country is a home for all those who yearn for freedom. And so I will share with you a brief tale of hope and struggle for the American dream and to support my wish to see the direct cash payment program enacted in our communities. The present system of benefits indicates that the government knows my problems, my choices, and my needs better than I do. Here is the reason why this is wrong, ineffective, and in need of immediate action. I applied for asylum when I was 19 years old. Disowned by my family, my country, hunted by nightmares and trauma, I found myself homeless, alone, and yet I was happy and proud that I could lean on the entity I dreamt of as a five-year-old child in Africa, a country where girls become rock stars, and a government that invests in free folks, ready to seek their potential. For 4 years, I have been the recipient of GRH and cash benefits. That means a roof on top of my head and an average of $100 per month, only in the form of grocery cards. I am a survivor. I needed to go to college. I needed job trainings, a cup of coffee to share with a friend, a car to lessen the harm on my physical disabilities during winter, gas, and maybe a suit and some makeup so I can keep pretending that I'm worth something. I worked to earn $40,000 scholarship, and yet I was held back by something called the LIHTC student rule. I live in youth government housing. So here I went fighting poverty, disability, and a federal law with a $100 Target gift card. I almost sold my kidney, but I instead decided to prove to you that I can make good choices under the most devastating circumstances. It took me a year. I worked, I begged, I climbed hierarchies with grievances and appeals so I could stay housed and use my scholarship. But 3 weeks before my first semester, I ended in the hospital receiving shock therapy. I was so exhausted and depressed that I simply couldn't move a muscle. Thanks to COVID stimulus checks, I was able to buy a car. I went to school and found a way to stay in housing. Every day I maintained a 4.0, and every day I had to fight the instant gratification offered by crime, drugs, prostitution, and suicide. Most of my young neighbors were not as resilient, and they are also recipients of GRH, PHA, and cash benefits. They also have access to the on-site social workers, whom I believe are here to help us make good decisions. What decisions are there to make with a grocery gift card? Today, I want you to know that I held my end when it comes to the promise of the American dream. 2 months ago, I was the first resident to earn a bachelor's in international relations at a facility which your counties and your taxes are funding. I would like to humbly declare that I'm not special. Many young Americans who lived at this facility could have done the same. They simply didn't have the capacity to endure as much pain and systemic incompetence as I did. The cost of navigating the current welfare system is too high to the extent where I promise you I can't provide the same amount of resilience and sanity anymore. Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to be here, and thank you for sharing your story with us today. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on this bill? Hearing none, we will close testimony. And members, do you have any questions on House File 2008 as amended, starting with Representative Finke, then Representative Keel, and then Representative Backer? Representative Finke, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, and thank you, Representative Kozlowski, for bringing this bill. I love this bill. I want to see more bills like this. I think that there are so many families and there are so many people in this country who we give direct cash payments to all the time, non-controversially. And very often we don't want to give those payments for reasons that are paternalistic or racist or worse to people who need that money the most. So I don't want one of your testifiers said that this allows people to be creative in solving their own problems, and I think that's one of the most important things that we can enable people to do is solve their own problems creatively and as they see fit. My question is, Section 1, Subdivision 5 says that the counties and youth prize shall establish a stipend amount. I'm not asking you what that will be, but do we have a sense of what others have offered and what that might look like?
Representative Kozlowski.
Chair Fisher and Representative Finke, thank you so much, and I couldn't agree with you more to your comments. We've seen cash stipends and the reporting that has gone and paired that's being proposed in this bill work very successfully as our states in New York and Winnipeg, Canada. There's, you know, examples of how this really, the outcomes are very good and put the money back in and the power back into the hands of people who have so often and systematically had that power stripped. But I actually want to open it up to my testifier to be able to explain a little bit more about, there's both the monthly cash stipend as well as the one larger stipend that would be available too.
Yeah. In Hennepin County, we're a little...
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Quincy Powell, if you'd like to go ahead.
And my other name is Christy Snyder. But I will say... It's okay. I will say that in Hennepin County, it'll be $1,000 a month, which roughly is around what shared housing outcomes would be in Hennepin County. However, if you're parenting, which is a foster youth, and parenting youth were a priority population for the young people that identified through the workshops. And so parenting youth will get $1,200 a month, and then they'll get a one-time stipend of $4,000 at any point during the 2 years.
Okay, thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I just want to make sure that's enough money to achieve the outcome that the pilot is trying to achieve. I'm sure other people will want to know if that's too much money, but is that enough money for these individuals to take the action that we're looking for them to take?
Is that a question?
That's a question.
Okay, and who would like to take that, Representative Kozlowski or Ms. Snyder?
We went back and forth around that, and the biggest concern was the end. What happens at the end, and that's something that people often talk about, which is why we put more in the one-time payment. What we have found is that moving from homelessness to being housed is so expensive. And perhaps the $4,000 isn't enough. We're seeing young people, I'm getting text messages from young people even in this room that are moving from homelessness to housed, and it's anywhere from $3,000 to up, and that's not even including getting a bed or furniture or anything like that. So that one-time payment could go up.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, next I have Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kozlowski. I wanted to know, first of all, what other states, I heard New York, but what other states have you seen this program provided, and what is the background on it? How is it working?
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and Representative Keel. And as I mentioned, there are other examples. New York is the only other one that I know of that has the focus on youth, and we do have a representative from Chapin Hall who has been working on these evidence-based. And actually, I believe that in New York, they're 1 year into their study, and so they can show a glimmer into the pathway of the successes and maybe some of the lessons learned at this point.
Thanks, Representative Kozlowski. Okay. So,
we go through the chair here, so no, I apologize for that. Ms. Berger-Gonzalez, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair. So, great question. We are currently up and running in New York City. Funding and pathways for implementing this are up and running. San Francisco will launch in May. Oakland, California will follow shortly thereafter. Boston, Baltimore, and LA County are all in the pipeline as well, setting up basically our runway for pulling all this data together and being able to say, across, including Minnesota, across nationally, this is the impact of this pilot program in all of these sites. New York, the outcomes that we've seen so far, again, these are super initial. Cash started starting to be dispersed in May of last year. What we're seeing is that a lot of young people are moving from homelessness to permanent housing or to some sort of temporary housing, staying with a family member until they figure things out, so moving out of a shelter. We are also seeing that young people are saving the money. It's the first time in their life that they've actually had a nest, and so they're holding on to it and saving it. So we're seeing an increase in savings. We've also seen a lot of young people leave jobs that where they're working three jobs with 1099s, and they're working jobs that are night shifts so they can find something more stable and invest in their own education. So those are some of the initial, and again, we're just about a year in. So this is the impact thus far.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a really, really new program. We don't really have data for a whole year of what this does. And I have some skepticism about making sure the rent gets from the person who receives it, because I'm looking at this. Do we have any way to track where that dollar is going? I noticed I think it's later, but I think when we hand out that first dollar, we certainly want to know where it's going and how it's being used, because unfortunately during COVID, I'm going to share this, it's a little different, but during COVID, I had people that owned rental units that did not want to kick their people out, and they were received COVID dollars, but they did not pay any part of their rent. And many times the renters would call, the owners would call and say, you know, I don't even care if they give me $100, even though they own me. And I live in a rural area, so rent is around $500, $600 for a basic one bedroom. They were not receiving it. So I think what we made a mistake on was we should have said, you know what, we'll help you with your rent during COVID, but oh, by the way, the person who is renting the building needs to sign off on that money so that we know that it's going where it needs to go. Now, granted, sometimes it's challenging to make that money go as far as you need it to go, but my concern is that we need to keep, we have a responsibility to the citizens of Minnesota. They want to help youth out. I actually personally believe they'd be better off in a family setting where they could get some more stability. You know, it's got to be awfully difficult to be left in a country. The young lady that talked about, oh my gosh, you went from Haiti to Minnesota. What a shock that was. I'm sure we weren't as warm. But just the other challenges with it, knowing where to go, what to do. And we just passed a bill Thursday? On homeless youth, also to provide them with facilities. But I just, being a parent of adult children now, knowing that that is a really important part of our life, to be able to have the direction and the support systems as you're trying to figure out what it is that you need to do, whether it's schooling or help with parenting or many other things, healthcare. I as a mother, I just have a real hard time with how we're looking at this. Mm-hmm. I really think there's some things we need to stop and think about. But one thing I would really urge is that we talk about where that money is, how we're accounting for it. And we picked a couple of the largest, maybe in your bill, the Hennepin County most populous, St. Louis County, not quite so much, and the distance in that county it will be challenging for people to get where they need to go. That's a big county anyway, and sparse. So, I'd like to know how we're going to track the recipients. Well, that'll be my last question with the stipends.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. And Representative Keel, really important questions and, thinking through, being really intentional. Of course, this is a pilot project, and so we're going to learn a lot. And also, I think one of the things about being in Minnesota is that, opportunity right now with the state, with the dollars that we have to go big so everybody can go home. And we did pass the Pathways Home Act, which I'm incredibly proud of. We need housing across all the continuum, especially for our youth to be able to get guaranteed cash plus assistance. And then access and find a place to, of their choosing, call home. You know, for me, the reason why I wanted to carry this bill, and why I'm so proud of our communities for choosing me to carry it forward with our community, is because I myself was, I didn't realize growing up that I was homeless, couching. And a program like this, where there were bouts of times when I was 16 and 17 as, you know, little leash, as a Mexican Ojibwe kid, non-binary, two-spirit person, I didn't know I was a statistic. And, you know, to the point of, like, having people with their families and community, I think that's the thing about our youth and the beauty of this, is that we have the state, we have the county, we have our community-based programs who know our youth, who are in our communities, and we have our youth driving this, and being able to trust them that we're going to have dollars that aren't going to compete with their food, with their other benefits that they're receiving. I'd just say that, you know, our youth, especially the youth of color, our LGBTQ youth and other, you know, our people, not who are down and out, but who have done more with less. And one thing we talk a lot about is that people figure out a way to survive, right? You find a couch, you find some food, and you find your people. And that's the piece that I'm looking forward to, that we have those, you know, entities who live and breathe best practices and evidence base, and that also, you know, as people moving through this, stats and numbers and statistics and accountability will surely be baked into this, but so too does the heart and trust, and that starts with stressing our youth. I would guess invite, again, my testifier to share a little bit more about, you know, working with the youth, and there will be housing navigators and people paired with our youth every step of the way. And I think that's also the important piece to keep in mind, that there will be guides and supports caked into this process. So, Chair, if you would allow my testifier to share.
But very briefly, we're running way over time right now. So we've got, I'll take a brief comment, and then we've got Representative Backer, and then we've got Representative Edelson, if they could keep their questions so we could get on to the other bills. Go ahead, Ms. Berger-Gonzalez.
Thank you so much. I'll be very brief, Representative Keel. On the tracking piece, there are dozens of guaranteed income cash transfer programs around the country that they have been tracking how individuals have been spending the money, and it's only resulting in spending on basic needs. This has been evident time and time again about how individuals are spending the cash. We have chosen in this pilot, because it's been co-designed with young people with lived expertise, to say that we're centering it in trust. So we are not tracking. What we are doing, though, is capturing outcomes on a monthly basis. And those outcomes are on housing, well-being, food insecurity. That's what's telling us about how young people are spending the cash. So we're very outcomes-focused, and this is something that we hope to bring to the committee and the legislature. And then I'll just second Representative Kozlowski's focus on, this is a cash plus model, meaning it's cash with optional supportive services. Those supportive services are driven to support those outcomes that I just mentioned. And that's because young people said we have both financial and non-financial barriers to getting housed. So that's what this program is really designed to do, is address those two pieces.
Thank you. We'll go to Representative Backer now.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. First question. I understand, unless I'm not reading this correctly, reporting of the success of this program doesn't start right away. It's like in St. Louis and Hennepin, it's like a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road. I think it would be prudent to get reporting right away. Did I misunderstand that when I was looking at the bill?
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Backer. You know, sorry, I didn't have the language right in front of me. I'm assuming we're talking about Section 3.1 in the report. And as I read it and understand that, yes, the report would be due to the legislature following. And I'm open. I've been working on a number of different bills where we've included a report and have more consistent reporting, and so if that's something that you would like to work on, I, you know, we welcome the conversation, especially as we begin a pilot.
Representative Becker.
Yeah, thank Chair, and thank you. I think that's a prudent. I mean, obviously, we have heard this is somewhat new on the block, okay? This is not like we have years and years of history. So you can't change course of what's working and focus on what's working instead of not what's working. As an EMS individual volunteer, we do know that substance abuse is a hard thing to overcome. Now, I'm not saying everybody that's going to get cash in this program has a substance abuse, but there will be a percentage of those people that will do that. They will. It's human nature to go to down that path. We've all have skeletons in our background, okay? So I would encourage to look at ways to do a report sooner to see what's working, what's not working, because obviously you're passionate about this to work. So that's my first thing, and I would be happy to work with you on that. Second thing, why did we pick 18 to 24? We do unfortunately have youth on our streets that are younger than 18. We have 16, we have 17, and probably, as we know, younger, not probably, we know that as a fact. Why 18 to 24? Why did that age group in this bill? That's my second to last question.
Okay. Representative Kozlowski.
Yes, thank you so much. And to the question, I think one of the important things to the report also is that part of this program will look, creating the cohort of folks who will participate. A portion will receive cash and a portion will not. And so that will also be reflected in. So look forward to continued conversations on reporting out on what is going to work best for illuminating the roadmap forward. And then in terms of, we've had a number of conversations for 18 to 24 and the carryover, and I will actually turn it over to my testifier to share more about why that specific age range.
Just very quick, we are way over time, mm-hmm. So, 30 seconds, please.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ms. Snyder.
So, I mean, because we don't have emancipated minor laws and that sort of thing, they can't have bank accounts without a parent or a guardian. And so we would want the 18 to 24-year-olds, because they're adults, they can open up bank accounts, they have the legal right to be able to be the authority and the legal person of record.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Edelson, quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kozlowski. I was going to ask a question, but I realize we are short on time. I just wanted to tell you thank you for this bill. If we could follow up just on a few things, but as somebody, I represent Edina, but and I think there's a lot of what people get from that. But when I was 16, I was homeless. And when I was 16, my mom was incarcerated. And those are things that are hard for me to say as well. And Representative Keel, you had talked about, that people should be with their families. Now, a lot of us don't have families. Mm-hmm. And I know you know that, Representative Keel. And Representative Backer, you had said years and years of history of making sure that we have reports. We have years and years of history of knowing that young people, especially if you don't have a family, and especially if you lack access to wealth, that you're left behind. You're treated less than. And so very happy to support this. And thank you for all your work.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. With that, I renew my motion that House File 2008, as amended, is referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor of referring House File 2008, as amended, to the Children and Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2008, as amended, is referred to the Children and Families Committee, Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. With that, we will go back to Representative Bierman, if you'd like to come forward. Our next House file is 1771. Because Representative Bierman is not a member of our committee, I will move to refer House File 1771 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. We have approximately 15 minutes for this bill. Representative Bierman, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 1771 is legislation that would create collaborative care management codes for psychiatry, thus expanding access to psychiatric and mental health care. Mental health conditions are more common than most people think, impacting 1 in 5 adults in our country. We are all aware of the increase in mental health care needed for Minnesotans in America. this bill would be a good step in the direction of getting more care and more efficient care to those in need. With that, I will turn it over to my testifier, Professor of Emeritus, Dr. George Realmuto, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Realmuto, if you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Bierman, I am Dr. George Realmuto, Professor Emeritus, Department of Psychiatry, spent 41 years in academia, and a dozen years as the medical director for the Wilmer Child Psychiatry Program. I'm very proud of that. And I want to talk about collaborative care. So I come to support this bill to ensure reimbursement for collaborative care codes. These billing codes must be established in law to ensure payment in both the private and commercial and public sector health systems. These codes pay for the unique interactions of a multidisciplinary healthcare team around the most complex and challenging health impairments. Patients with this burden of illness should not be deprived of this evidence-based method of care delivery. I would like to give you an example from a health system that I worked in. A large academic hospital did a review of repeat hospitalizations and emergency department visits to examine common reasons for this expensive and not always effective treatment management practice. Not surprisingly, the common thread for this ineffective utilization of care was the complexity, number of illnesses, and the presence of comorbid mental health and or addiction disorders. It was clear that the primary care clinician alone was insufficient to prevent overutilization of unnecessary services. A collaborative care clinic was established with a team that consisted of a primary care physician, a consulting psychiatrist, and a care manager. So I think most of you understand what a psychiatrist does, probably and would understand what a primary care physician does. It is the care manager that makes this a different model than what we see elsewhere. Each of these professionals work at the top of their professional license. The primary care clinician is supported, educated, and guided to manage the mental health, the complex mental health and addiction needs by the psychiatrist. The roles and responsibilities are detailed in the handout that I sent you. This is a very dynamic. So then there's the care manager. I want to say a little bit about the care manager position. May not be familiar as the other professional roles in this on this team. The dynamic nature of the multiple illnesses requires a high level of communication among the team. The patient and family need a go-to person, which can be the care manager, when unexpected crises or adverse reactions occur within the patient. The plan by the primary care physician can be updated, and the team can have a check-in with the care manager. This information is passed to the patient and from the patient, and at team meetings and other collaborative meetings, the professionals discuss the plan and in a proactive way present solutions to the patient. This approach has been shown to decrease emergency room visits and hospitalizations. This is an efficient, effective, and more humane service delivery model with high patient satisfaction. The collaborative care model was disbanded at this hospital, my hospital, because the reimbursement for care did not follow the service upgrade that the model delivered. The collaborative care codes include reimbursement for communication, plan revision, consultation, and patient-initiated contact. For those of you familiar with ACT teams, community program. There are these kinds of interdisciplinary professionals who work around very complex cases. Another model that uses interdisciplinary treatment professionals is the CCBHC, Comprehensive Community Behavioral Health Clinics. That's very successful in that setting as well. So if you understand how these collaborative models work, if you have in an outpatient setting someone with mental health, addiction, multiple health care problems, and you give it all to a primary care physician, the article in the Strib yesterday that said physicians need 27 hours to complete their work, it's not working. You can't give all of that responsibility and expect the primary care physician to know all they need to know. And that's why you have these two other professionals, and that's why you need a collaborative care model so that all of them can be paid and the reimbursement will perpetuate that model. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House File 1771? You're not seeing any? Oh,
Peter.
Yes, Mr. Hughes.
Can I give you 30 seconds?
Yes, come on over.
I'll do it quick. Hi, Mark Hughes, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. As you can see, I've hopefully been a good member of the disability community over the years. I agree with this bill. I have taken care of a stepmother with Alzheimer's who's passed. My dad has been just diagnosed with dementia. And Heather said we need to go with, not go without. And I'll never forget those words that woke me up. The reason I disagree with this part of it, it's not just for people who have regular insurance or have a business, and I do. But it should be covered under the medical assistance, too, so that the people who are disabled are well taken care of. They should have the same right to insurance as those of us who can make it on our own. And that's the stipulation that I've looked at the most, is that one for all and all for one. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hughes. With that, go to members, Representative Hicks and then Representative Baker, and then we'll go to the vote. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for this bill. I agree with that, too. We want to make sure it's covered in Medicaid as well. But I do just want to say, if you have ever sat trying to navigate our mental health system with any type of insurance, identifying how all of those pieces need to work together for success is really difficult. And making sure that everyone can get that coordination and that our providers can be compensated for it so that we can do it right is so important, especially when we're dealing with individuals who maybe have substance use disorder and a coexisting mental health condition. And so we're looking at a lot of complex providers in the mix. And so I just wanted to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for this one. Very important that we make sure people get the help they need when they need it so we can keep them moving forward on their life plan. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bierman, thank you for this. Again, I really support this work. This is the collaborative care model is something that we've been missing for quite some time, and I will tell you, working with Dr. Romuto, he gets it right because he thinks it through, and I've done this before with him on other bills. Thank you, George, for that. And again, he does care deeply about these patients. And this is another form. I know it's putting pressure on the health plans. I know there's an expense to this, but it's bringing badly needed dollars to our overall medical community that needs to help kind of fill in the gaps that we're missing. So thank you for that. Really want to support this bill. Thanks again. I know we're short of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. With that, I renew my motion to refer House File 1771 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries and House File 1771 is referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you for being here today. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Our next bill on the document is House File 1695 from Chair Nelson. Since Chair Nelson is not a member of our committee, I will move to refer House File 1695 back to State and Local Government Finance and the Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Chair Nelson. So folks know we've got about 15 minutes for this bill. Chair Nelson, I understand you have an A1 author's amendment. I will move the A1 author's amendment. Chair Nelson, can you please explain the A1 author's amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A1 amendment, it adds two MOUs or memorandums of understanding that were negotiated last year and are technically separate from the contract. In fact, they are substantially the same MOUs from 2022 that passed in the House HHS supplemental omnibus bill, but failed that when there was no budget deal. The ratification and the funding for both will be in the governor's HHS budget bill. One resolves a set of issues related to temporary emergency PCA rate increases that were passed at the start of the COVID emergency, where some of the workers in the bargaining unit did not receive the money from their agencies. The other provides a stipend to help workers defray the cost of complying with the federal electronic visit verification fraud prevention program. And I have Ms. Weber here if there are any questions.
Okay.
That's the amendment.
Ms. Weber, Director Weber, do you have any testimony you'd like to offer at this point on explaining the bill?
Mr. Chair, members.
Amendment. Excuse me, the amendment.
I'm Michelle Weber with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and I don't have additional information. Representative Nelson provided a nice overview of the memorandums of understanding.
Very good. So we'll go to the vote on the A1 amendment. Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and the A1 amendment is adopted. We now go to the bill as amended. Chair Nelson.
Thank you, members, and Chair Fisher. House File 1695 ratifies the contract that was recently agreed upon between the self-directed home health care workers, represented by SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and the state of Minnesota. The contract will be funded by a different bill, House File 2516, that will be heard in the Human Services Finance Committee. The funding language will also be carried in the governor's Human Services budget bill. The SEIU members voted to ratify the contract, and the MMB submitted to the Legislative Coordination Committee. The contract covers approximately 29,000 workers in three self-directed home care programs that include PCA Choice, where the clients qualify for hours of service, and two budget programs, the Medicaid-funded consumer-directed community support program and the state fund-only funded consumer support grants program. That's easy for me to say. The programs are all self-directed where the clients recruits, trains, and supervises the workers. These are what we commonly call the public or personal care attendants and to simplify, but anyway. The agencies, these programs are all self-directed and supervise the worker. The agency serves only as a fiscal entity to process payroll. The contract does not apply to the workers in the traditional or agency PCA programs. In that program, the agency hires, trains, and supervises the work on behalf of the client. Those workers are private sector employees of the agency. I should note, however, that while those workers are not covered by the contract, the agencies will receive the same rate increase without the same requirement that they pass the funding along to the workers. Since they gained the right to form a union, this will be the fifth contract. Every time we have made progress, but this contract stands out as a game changer. The contract raises the minimum hourly wage from $15.25 an hour to $19 an hour in January, and next year to $20 an hour in January of that year. Higher wages will fight the enormous workforce shortage that we face in the home care industry. We currently face over 10,000 unfilled home care positions in Minnesota. I am sure that we have all heard the horrific stories of disabled clients suffering or even dying in their homes because they were unable to find a caregiver. For the first time, we have a contract that will allow us to make a real dent in the workforce shortages. We will no longer keep pace with the market, but now we will get ahead of it and attract workers that we need. These workers, predominantly women of color, and women and people of color, have been essential to workers during the COVID pandemic. They stood by their clients during the worst of times. Now it is our time to value their work. before I turn it over to Ms. Weber to fully explain the details of the contract, I want to highlight some of the important points. This is a bipartisan effort. I would like to thank Representative Schumacher and Kresha for co-authoring the bill with me. Second, this is an open shop contract, and although the workers enjoy the benefits of the contract, no worker is required to join the union or pay dues of any or a fair share dues. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Weber.
Thank you. Director Weber, if you'd like to go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, as mentioned, I'm Michelle Weber with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and we provide staff and administrative support to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, which is the recipient of the contract on behalf of the legislature. This agreement covers approximately 29,000 providers. As Representative Nelson mentioned, it increases the minimum hourly wage from $15.25 an hour to $19 an hour on January 1st, 2024, or within 30 days of federal approval of a state plan and waiver amendment. It then increases the wage to $20 an hour on January 1st, 2025. It creates a tiered wage structure for PCA Choice or CFSS on January 1st of 2025 or within 90 days of federal approval that will range from $20 an hour to $22.50 an hour, depending on the cumulative number of hours worked since July 1st, 2017. It replaces two floating holidays with recognition of Independence Day and Veterans Day as paid holidays and also adds Juneteenth in calendar year 2024. It creates an orientation committee to design orientation programming and dedicates $500,000 each year for that work. It provides $3 million for stipends for individuals who have completed orientation sessions. It permits the parties to create a joint labor management trust fund, with the state providing $1 million for future programs. It increases funds available for $500 training stipends from $1 million to $2 million. It also includes a letter of agreement that provides $1,000 stipends for providers with 6 months of service and includes $50 million for those stipends. The overall projected costs of the agreement are $302.7 million in fiscal year 24 and 25, and then $490.6 million in fiscal year 26-27. The memorandums of understanding that were amended into the bill today also provide there's two memorandums of understanding that are ratified. The first one provides $1.4 million for up to $1,000 stipends to providers who provided services between December 1st, 2020 and February 7th, 2021. And it requires DHS to cooperate with the Department of Labor and Industry when reviewing complaints from providers. The second MOU provides $5.6 million for $200 stipends to offset the cost of using individual devices for the electronic visit verification program, and it requires DHS to provide training. And that's an overview of the agreements that are ratified by this bill.
Okay, thank you, Director Weber. We'll go to testifiers now. I've got Matthew Bergeron. If you'd like to come down and given the time that we have, you'll have 2 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matthew Bergeron from Larkin Hoffman. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. They are a statewide association of PCA agencies. You all heard from me a couple of weeks ago on a bill related to the PCA rate framework and some conversations about how we recognize the cost of providing these services and how we calculate the reimbursement that the state provides in that space. Here today to do two things. One, speak very strongly in support of the benefits and wages in this contract in a era of workforce shortages and competition for workers. It is absolutely imperative that this state support and invest in this essential level of care delivery. But I also need to flag for you some concerns. Now, I understand this is a policy committee and not the fiscal committee, and so most of my concerns have to do with the fiscal note and the calculations as to the reimbursement rate necessary to provide these benefits. But in light of it being a policy committee, the note I did want to provide is, as we see the estimates for the cost of providing these services that are in the governor's budget and the reimbursement rate associated with the wage increases in this, there's some very real concerns that it relies on a couple of assumptions in the mathematic process that will have very detrimental impacts on small, culturally specific, BIPOC-owned agencies that maybe don't have other service delivery lines. They're not also providing 245D waiver services and are also not Medicare home health agencies or have other resources that have allowed them to pay higher wages. The one note I will just leave you with is we believe that in order to pay for a dollar in wages, the state has to provide at least a dollar's worth of reimbursement. And the first year in the contract has a $3.75 wage increase and a $3.32 increase in the reimbursement. That takes no into account for the payroll taxes, the unemployment insurance, and the workers' comp that we know are directly tied to wages. And so we've been looking, working with a number of you all and with the Department of Human Services to revisit that estimate. So thank you for the moment today.
Thank you, Mr. Bergeron. Next, I have Carrie Alderman. Carrie, Alderman, if you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself, and please keep your comments to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Adelman. My family lives in Lakeville. I represent SEIU Minnesota and Iowa with over 50,000 caregivers across Minnesota, including 29,000 home care workers covered by this contract. Some members, like myself, are family caregivers. Others have joined this career field to serve others. I became a caregiver in 2015. My son, Keegan, a husband, father of three, and Iraqi war veteran, was involved in a motor vehicle accident. He sustained life-threatening injuries, including broken bones, internal injuries, and a severe traumatic brain injury. My son is unable to speak, feed himself, walk, or perform any activities of daily living. After 10 months in hospitals, we were told to find a nursing home for him. Instead, we brought him home with absolutely no idea what we were doing. We quickly realized that to keep my son alive, we would need help from other caregivers. Unfortunately, there was no help available. The wages were very low, and everyone we recruited had better options. Because of the shortage, I gave up a six-figure career to become his caregiver. And while I have no regrets, I would have liked to continue working and contributing. Becoming a caregiver will have a long-term significant financial impact on my life. Within this contract, we raised the wage floor from current $15.25 to $19 an hour in 2024 and to $20 an hour in 2025. We have created a tiered wage structure for the first time, which recognizes commitment and longevity in the field with step-up increases to $22.50. We provide a $1,000 bonus for workers who stay in the field beyond 6 months to better retain workers. We will also build a professional orientation program which prepares caregivers for the work ahead. I hope now I can recruit staff and maybe even return to my career. I also want to address the questions about whether DHS has accurately projected the cost of our contract. To start, our union wants DHS to be accurate. We gain nothing if DHS underfunds it. This is a technical issue, and we rely on DHS to get it right. Since providers have first raised this issue, we have encouraged DHS to take their concerns seriously, and we even help set up meetings to discuss the issue. We're glad that this year DHS made a small adjustment to their calculation. We still think, however, that it's an open question whether their calculation provides sufficient funding to pay for the full value of the wage increases in our contract. Finally, I want to thank you for hearing the bill to ratify this amazing contract. In the past, we have been able to do this work because of bipartisan support. Because of the support that we had in the legislature. This is a life-changing contract for thousands and thousands of Minnesotan caregivers and recipients. Thank you all.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to speak? Hearing none, are there any questions from members? Chair Noor, very quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Nelson, for bringing this bill forward. I totally agree with increasing the wages for the PCA. Just quick question, the 302.7 and also the 490.6 in 2627, is that the total amount for choice and traditional, or is it only the choice that is listed here?
Chair Nelson.
I'll let Ms. Weber answer that.
Director Weber.
Mr. Chair and members, that's the anticipated total cost of the full agreement in this current biennium, so all of the provisions that are included in the agreement. The memo that I provided, the last page of that, has a breakdown of the cost for each of the aspects of the agreement.
Chair Nort.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Webb, I just wanted to clarify, is this for both traditional PCA plus the choice PCA, because they're two different, I think, we've had from the testimony.
Director Weber. Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, the Department of Human Services is on their way here, and they can provide that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Welcome to the table. Please introduce yourself and answer the question.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and Representative Knorr. That total is for both traditional and choice providers.
And introduce yourself too, please.
Sorry. For the record, Elise Bailey, Budget Director for Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Chair Knorr?
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up with Ms. Sure. Bailey. So in the contract that we're ratifying today in terms of approval, does that, if we have an opportunity to increase the rate, are we, do we have to bind by that if we're going to be increasing beyond just the negotiated contract?
Ms. Bailey.
Chair Fisher, Representative Knorr, we can certainly add to the rate increase that's contained within this agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
All right, very good. With that, I renew my motion to refer House File 1695 as amended to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All the opposed signify by saying nay. Motion carries and House File 1695 as amended is referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Next bill will be House File 1604. We will have 15 minutes for this at max, and then we've been authorized to go for until approximately a quarter to 12 o'clock, excuse me, to 2:45. So that we'll have time for the next bill after that. So since Representative Chair Freiberg is not a member of the committee, I move to refer House File 1604 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee, Chair Freiberg. I understand you have an A1 amendment, author's amendment. I will move your A1 author's amendment. Would you like to explain it, please?
Sure. This just makes some technical changes and puts a timeline in place.
Okay, very good. Any questions? Hearing none, all in favor of the A1 author's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Nay. The amendment is adopted, and we will go on to Chair Freiberg. Please explain House File 1604 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 1604 establishes an emergency grant program that aims to support the stability of the autism treatment provider sector. It would award grant money to qualified early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention, or EIDBI, providers who sustained deep financial losses during and after the pandemic. The purpose of the medical assistance EIDBI benefit is to provide medically necessary early intervention for children who have autism spectrum disorder and related conditions, as well as to educate, train, and support their parents and families, promote people's independence and participation in family, school, and community life, and improve long-term outcomes and the quality of life for children and their families. EIDBI providers are unable to make up losses because they are reimbursed on a stagnant medical assistance fee for service payment schedule. Inflation and a dramatic drop in staffing also worsened a workforce crisis that predated the pandemic. EIDBI providers are increasingly unable to serve existing families and the many, many children and families who currently wait to start services. Staffing shortages have led to major disruptions in treatment frequency and consistency. Agencies are not able to enroll to capacity, often having to operate in fewer days of the week and fewer hours in the day, delivering less than the recommended treatment hours. Significant wait lists of children and families who want to begin EIDBI supports and services are growing statewide, with some agencies advertising a two-year wait on their websites. In order to deliver on the promise of early intervention for all that the MA benefit envisions and meet federal obligations to deliver MA benefits, we need to pass House File 1604 to stabilize the EIDBI provider sector and work on ways to continue to build provider capacity to serve children and families. There are multiple letters of support for this bill in your packet, and with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay, very good. First person I have on the list is Mr. Jay O'Neill. I'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair Fisher and members of the committee.
My name is Jay O'Neill, and I'm owner of Behavioral Dimensions. We are an agency who provides the EIDVI services that was just referred to. We do the intensive early behavioral intervention. We serve primarily young children in the age range from two to seven or eight. Primarily, we will serve some older kids as we're able. We are currently serving approximately 90 children within 20 counties within Minnesota, several of those in the rural parts of the state, and we employ about 50 employees who are delivering those services. All of our services are conducted right in families' homes. I'm also representing the Autism Treatment Association of Minnesota. We are a group of agencies who provide early intensive intervention. We all work very closely together to make sure that we're doing as much as we can to provide as many services as possible to all families in Minnesota. My agency in particular has really experienced some significant financial losses as a result of the pandemic surges over the past several years, which also has shown in the increased staffing shortages and turnover during the Great Resignation. Along with that, we have the ongoing increased cost of doing business from inflation. Really, all increases that we're seeing in our expense categories are increasing. All the insurances we have to pay are going up as well. And as mentioned, our reimbursement rates haven't changed in a long time. 100% of our services, our revenue is through fee-for-services, as was mentioned. We only get paid for the hours we bill. There was thousands of hours of canceled services due to COVID and the related situations. And almost every single day over the past 3 years, we have had services canceled due to some type of COVID situation, whether it be with the families that we're serving or our staff. Several of the months that we were working, we were providing approximately 70% of the hours that we promised families, but yet we still needed to pay our employees 100% of their wages to be able to retain the ones that were still with us. Agencies like ours serving the rural parts of the state are really considerably impacted by COVID. There's a well-documented staff provider shortages that significantly impact rural parts of the state. In 2022, our agency alone received 140 requests for services. We were able to serve five of those children. And those five children we were able to serve were primarily because five of our kids had transitioned to educational programs. So we didn't expand any services. We were just able to maintain what we were doing. We currently have 13 full-time positions open within our company throughout Minnesota. We have Behavioral Dimensions has suffered losses each of the last 2 years totaling six figures. This is obviously not sustainable. While struggling just to stay open, we obviously cannot engage in the recruitment and retention activities we need in order to provide the services that we commit to the families we serve, and certainly cannot expand to more services for more families. Prior to COVID, we were able to start implementing tuition reimbursement systems, retention bonuses for becoming certified or licensed in related fields, and retention bonuses for longevity. Those have all been suspended. I fear that without this emergency funding, agencies may go out of business, further reducing the number of children receiving services. The relief grant through House File 1604 will allow us to recruit and effectively train and support more employees, and also really looking at the retention of our key employees by keeping current benefits in place, improving our benefits, and resuming our tuition reimbursement and bonus systems. At this time, that's all I have, and I thank you for your time.
Welcome. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for sharing your experiences. Next, I have Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you. If you'd like to come forward, please. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Eric Larson. I'm a licensed psychologist and board-certified behavior analyst serving 45 children through our organization here in the Twin Cities area. In the interest of time, I'll simply highlight we have a one-page handout that's in your files that shows three graphs provided to us, gleaned by us from DHS provider data. The top graph simply shows the dramatic drop in reimbursement that we suffered as a group of providers beginning in the fall of 2021, whereas the program was just initiated in 2013. DHS had worked very hard to refine the benefit and improve the delivery of services over the subsequent 5 years, and we thought we just hit it right when the pandemic hit and then the federal supports dropped and all of a sudden our staff started resigning. You see the impact in the second graph. The total number of children receiving services dropped by 60%, and the total number of new children able to initiate services dropped by 165%, and these drops have continued to this day.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to testify? Not seeing anybody. Members, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this bill. I just want to say that for a really, really long time, we didn't have services for our children. Some of our children waited on a wait list until they were too old to attend services. And so it's really important to me that families and kids like my child have access to services. And if this benefit crumbles under the financial strain, since, as you mentioned, it's never had a rate increase since its inception in 2013, there will be over 30,000 children with autism who will not have access to this service. And so I just want to be in complete and total support. We never got services. We sat on a wait list. And I don't want that for any other mom. It is incredibly painful to be told that there is something that will help your child, and go get it, mom, go get the thing that will help your child, and to call everybody who provides that service in your community and to be told, we'll put you on the wait list for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years, for 4 years. Imagine if your child had a health condition that needed treatment and the outcome of their life was based on getting treatment for that health condition. And you have people that do the treatment, but the wait list is so long that you can't get it for your child. And there is nothing as a parent you can do about it. Because no matter where you call and how far you look, nobody has an opening, even if you move. So it's imperative that this service not collapse. And so I would ask members to please look deep into your hearts about how this is an opportunity to use one-time funding to stabilize a very important sector of our support network.
Thank you. Representative Hicks, and then we'll go to Representative Engen, and then we'll be voting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I think it's, as we just heard from Representative Hicks, this is sorely needed. It needs to happen. We have a duty and a job to make sure that it happens efficiently and effectively. And from the perspective of agencies or providers, they want to know kind of what parameters are around this grant. One thing that I'm looking at here, the commissioner may consider other relevant factors. This is on line 2.22. In addition to those listed in paragraph B, is there any additional thoughts or information that we can provide for agencies or providers to ensure that they know that they have the ability to seek out these grants?
Chair Freiberg.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Engen, for the question. Could you just restate the question just in relation to the language on line 2.22? Are you wondering about examples of other relevant factors in addition to? This does spell out the criteria that the commissioner shall review in determining whether or not they receive the grant. So I guess I'm just, if you could just restate the question, that would be helpful.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg. Yes, so I've overseen grant writing processes before in another life. And I think folks just want to know, is there something else that they should be looking for in addition to the list of what they should contain in their grant process? Is there anything else that this might allude to that maybe they're not aware of, or does this allow DHS to include other questions that maybe, you know, members of this committee aren't aware of in their approval process.
Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, I think Dr. Larson indicated he had some
ideas. Dr. Larson, go ahead. Yes, sir.
Chair Fisher. I looked at the language and I compared it to other grant programs that DHS administers, and so this is a standard clause in the grants that I looked at, the grant programs I looked at, and so I just take it as a cushion for discretion in case things come up that weren't anticipated in the writing of the bill.
Representative Engen.
No further questions. I just think when we go about this business, we should make sure that we have parameters that are easily understood by everybody so that we're not accidentally leaving some out because they're providing great work. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Seeing there's no further discussion, Chair Freiberg, I will renew my motion to refer House File 1604 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All say nay. Motion carries, and the House File 1604 is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. With that, Representative Baker, come on down. Welcome to the committee. This is our final bill today. It's House File 2551 for Representative Baker. Representative Baker, if you'd like to introduce your bill, move and introduce your bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2551 from this committee to the Human Services Finance Committee, please, and I'll explain the bill.
Very good. Representative Baker moves to refer House File 2551 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Representative Baker, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, again, this is an important bill that helps people with substance use disorder, and one of the best treatments that we've been able to find in the last couple of years is with opioid treatment medicine. Medically assisted treatment is doing amazing things in keeping people in recovery much, much longer. What this bill does is it changes a couple of things. It first changes the modifies when treatment plan reviews must take place. Currently, when somebody arrives to a business that dispenses methadone, for example, they have intensive visits with the provider, the counselor. They go through a lot of weekly checks to make sure everybody's stable. They're not using a lot of testing and so on. This also allows a little bit of a paperwork reduction, and this is something that takes a lot of pressure off of these licensed alcohol drug counselors to make sure that they are spending a little bit more time with the clients, a little bit less on the paperwork, and they're finding that once they're stabilized, they don't need that intensity. So moving it from a month to 3 months after the first 10 weeks, we're not shortening up that initial stuff. It's important to do. And the second, it allows these licensed drug alcohol counselors to see more patients. Some states have no limits on what they're offering. Some are down to as little as 30. We are pushing it up to about 75. We still think there should be a limit. But this will allow more drug counselors to see more patients in this field because, again, up front, they spend a lot of time with these folks. But as it goes along and they're in this recovery journey for 1 to 5 years sometimes, and sometimes longer. They just need that time, and so this bill just really clarifies this for us. We think this is a really important bill to get more people accessible to these services, and with that, I have a testifier here today, Mr. Chair, that would like to tell a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Baker. And we have Debbie Gray, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, who you're with, and then begin your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Debbie Gray. I am the Regional Clinical Director for Minnesota at Behavioral Health Group. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker and a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of House File 2551. This bill is about saving lives. It will have an immediate impact by allowing greater access to opioid treatment and will support counselors in focusing on the urgent needs of client care. Our communities are suffering as lives are being lost at an alarming rate because of the opioid epidemic. In fall 2022, Millennium Health, the predominant drug testing lab in Minnesota, reported a 400% increase in illicit fentanyl positivity in their analysis of urine samples from 2019 to 2022. Some regions in the state were even higher. St. Louis County, for example, reported a shocking 2,500% increase in fentanyl positivity during the same time period. At the same time, the addiction treatment field wrestles with this alarming increase in fentanyl use. It also faces a workforce crisis. The Minnesota Department of Employment, Economic and Development projected a need for over 3,500 new LADC counselors in Minnesota between 2016 and 2026. And that report was published before COVID. More recent information shared by the Minnesota Department of Human Services shows that the crisis is compounding as the need has continued to increase while current counselors are leaving the field. Deaths among Minnesotans from opioid-involved overdoses increased 44% from 2020 to 2021. The need for people to get help with opioid disorders is urgent, but the current regulations mean that many of them are forced to wait until their openings once they seek help. Currently, when counselors' caseloads are full in an opioid treatment program, they are required to stop taking new patients. Over the past year, every OTP program in the state of Minnesota has had to close their admissions for new patients at least once. This situation makes it harder for people in crisis to access care. House File 2551 proposes to increase the caseload cap of counselors and OTPs from 50 to 75. The guidelines for OTP providers include many provisions that protect patients and ensure good clinical care. In my opinion, ratios or caps on caseloads often do not. The ratios do not recognize that each patient has unique clinical needs. Some have lower needs and some more intense. For some counselors, a caseload of 50 patients is appropriate, especially if it consists of a new or at-risk patient. However, as patients are stabilized, their needs decrease and the caseloads can be higher. Rather relying on rigid ratios, this bill borrows new language from federal guidelines, and it also allows the local supervisors to determine what is clinically appropriate below that. The second element of this bill would decrease the workload burden on counselors by changing the frequency of treatment plan reviews for stable patients from monthly to every 3 months. This proposed change would free up clinical staff to spend more time with patients. Programs will continue to provide evidence-based quality care, but with this change, they can invest more resources directly with patients face-to-face. This change is also consistent with federal guidelines, which refer to quarterly reviews. I ask that you pass House File 2551. The changes in this bill will have an immediate impact by increasing access to needed care and saving lives. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, is there anyone else from the public who would like to speak to this bill? Not seeing any. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll be brief. Thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this forward. This sits right at an intersection that I know is important to a lot of us, human services and public safety. I think this is an incredibly smart but effective bill, and I'm just really glad to support it, and I'm happy to sign on. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Baker, I also want to say thank you for the work that you've been doing this field. I know that you've got a real deep passion here, and
you
appreciate your continued commitment to moving this forward. With that, Representative Baker, if you'd like to make any closing comments,
just
and renew your motion.
Yep, Mr. Chair members, again, this is part of the low-hanging fruit that we can actually help with right now. It's a workforce relief, kind of a relief button, if you will, plus it just gives us more wiggle room in the centers that we're doing some good work. So with that, members, thank you for your support. Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to refer the House File 2551 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
All those in favor of referring House File 2551 to the Human Services Finance Committee, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. House File 2551 is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Seeing no further business before the committee, our next hearing will be Wednesday, March 8th, where we'll be hearing a number of bills from myself and several other members. And with that, we are adjourned.